Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to the Foundation Podcast. We are the Lorehounds, your guides to psycho history. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our coverage of the Apple TV Plus original series, Foundation.
In this podcast, we're going to be doing a scene-by-scene breakdown of Season 2, Episode 3, King and Commoner.
Be sure to stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes about our podcasting schedule for the rest of July and maybe a peek into August.
For early access and ad-free episodes of all of our podcasts, visit us at patreon.com/thelorehound. We have exclusive content. We're about to close out our birthday month and going to be sending out a very special thank you gift to anyone who is a subscriber by the end of the month. And to all of those people who just subscribed in the last few days, thank you so much. You'll be getting a sticker. Excited for that. Also, if you're enjoying our content and want to give us a leg up, think about leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. Ratings and reviews help people find our podcast, even on Terminus.
We love to respond to your questions, thoughts, and theories on air, so send us feedback for the next episode.
You can send emails to empire@thelorehounds.com or head over to our website. And over there, we've got a voicemail feature or a contact form. You can also post a message in our Discord server. We've got an active channel just set up for Foundation. People are talking, having a fun time. You can find the links to our website and the Discord in the show notes.
If I could plug that, Marilyn has discovered Foundation and she's got a lot to say. She's got medieval history to pull in. Ooh. She's got everything. So if you want a nice deep talk about Foundation, you hop on in that channel and there will be people to take care of you.
I believe Marilyn too. This is a formative series of books for her. And So she is able to really give it a good analytical academic view of from the TV show, for the books, as well as her own personal history. So,
yeah. Should be good. And maybe we'll have her on later in the season. Who knows?
Ooh, that would be fun.
Would be fun. So, David, let's do a little bit of background here. I know you have this listed as Asimov, but don't worry. You're shaking your head, but don't worry. Davy Mack to the rescue.
Oh, yeah?
Has written in with a very long, detailed thing on Asimov.
No way. I didn't see that. I have had a crazy busy week. We've got some vacation coming up in August. And so I've been cramming a lot of stuff. So Davy Mack, thank you so much. That's amazing.
Thank you, other David. Davy Mack says, hey, David, I'm glad that you're doing such a deep dive on Asimov. And I'm looking forward to hearing it as I actually don't know a ton about him. But one thing I'm curious to see if you're covering is his relationship to women, both inside and outside of his fiction. Yes. Seems like early in his career, he didn't think romance or sex should exist in sci-fi. But later in life, he changed his attitude and tried to build some fiction around different sexes of aliens. Mm-hmm. I'd be really curious to hear more about that, especially given that the adaptation has put a few female characters front and center in a way that I don't think Asimov did in his books. And I think the adaptation is all the better for it. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I actually have been doing some reading and listening. There's a great YouTube. Well, I've been enjoying it. Called YouTube channel called Quinn's. Oh, is it Quinn's Ideas? Quinn's Theories? I don't know. I'll look it up later when I
actually we'll link it.
Yeah, and he does some great stuff. I was watching some interviews with Asimov, some old PBS stuff on Bill Moyers. There was a interview that Fresh Air republished that had him giving a lecture. And as I've been digging around, yeah, the Isaac Asimov, the man with 1,000 hands, he would definitely be going through some things in this generation.
Well, speaking of hands, also, yeah. It seems he was greatly grabby with women at conventions.
That's what I
basically
was.
Oh,
is this in Davey's
off.
Mac email?
This is Davey Mac's email. Okay. And basically wrote it off as them being into it, which is pretty gross. It is pretty gross. I mean, I know a lot of sci-fi fantasy writers of that era probably did the same kind of thing, but I just think in a comprehensive discussion about the man, it would be good to include some of this kind of thing too.
Agreed. And I've read a couple of articles regarding this. And I think from the way I gather it, not only his own personal reflections, but then as if we look over the course of his career as a first generation immigrant, uh-huh. coming into the country, growing up in Brooklyn, and then later living in Manhattan, as his intellect grew and as he matured, and then as he increased his stature increased in the science fiction world, in the academic world, as a thinker, as a somebody who's leading public thought and having ideas about religion and society, uh-huh. and being asked to speak on those in not just, you know, science fiction conventions, but, you know, in general, his ego started to grow,
probably, yeah,
proportional,
yeah, as it would.
And, you know, everybody's got different physiologies and stuff, and maybe his libido was a little bit higher than others. And so I think given some of those historical factors about the state of relationships between men and women and the sort of patriarchal attitudes, I believe he was a very inappropriate person towards women in a large way. And I think that increased as he grew in his career because he had greater and greater power. He had greater and greater. Yeah. And so that is definitely marked part by that has marred, I think, to some degree, his career as a man, you know. And again, how do we separate the ideas from the person? And we can certainly say from what I understand that I'm learning about his, you know, who he was. He's a Tolkien to science fiction as Tolkien is to fantasy. I would say maybe Asimov is to science fiction. Or Tolkien is to fantasy.
That's a big statement.
Yeah, this idea of galactic empires. He coined the term robotics.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah, he coined the term positronic, which obviously we use in Star Trek for, you know, Commander Data or his brain. So he's the first one to open up a whole bunch of these ideas and then get into this real epic millennia, looking way down the range at human history. So things like Dune wouldn't exist. You know, obviously all of our science fiction and fantasy are marked by, you know, big names like this that have come before. And I believe Asimov may be considered of that stature of Tolkien. So, I mean, write in if you've got a different opinion. But as I'm reading and learning more about the man and what he wrote, more and more, it seems like he is a really, sorry, no pun intended, foundational to the modern science fiction genre. Not Buck Rogers, zoop, zoom, you know, flying around in a spaceship rescuing, you know, damsels in distress and being swarthy, you know, being Conan in space or something.
But more like
that.
A space opera kind of thing coming in.
Yeah. Galactic empires that span millennia, you know, millions of planets. What does that mean? Robotics. What does it mean when society is far flung out into the stars? And where, you know, the life and death of these great empires are, you know, taking millennia. No one had gone there yet. And so
he
is the one who really opened that space up.
Well, thank you, Davey Mack, for writing in. And indeed, for the reminder to keep your hands to yourself at conventions, even if you're Isaac Asimov. So yeah, it's tough to separate the man from the art. I think this art in particular is pretty separated from the original work. So yeah, it's maybe a little bit easier to separate it from that because it's mostly the big ideas that have permeated the science fiction landscape that we're basing this off of rather than the specific plot lines of the Foundation series. Now that we're through Asimov, what did you think of this episode of the adaptation?
Well, this is, I'll springboard off of that too and point out something that I have in my notes for my thoughts on this episode, which is David Goyer, the showrunner for this, is taking a really expansive view of humanity going forward.
Yeah.
And looking at how are we going to be with different relationships and, you know, colors of skin and modalities of life and religions and philosophies when we're inhabiting millions of worlds. And so to bring forward a character like Bel Rios in this and have it, you know, two men in this very committed and loving relationship and it just being normal, right? Having a cast that looks like the Earth, right? And casting, oh, you're an actor, you're good, you're nailing the part, you've got the vibe. Okay, I don't care what your skin color is. You know, you're the person that we're going to hire mm-hmm. for this role. So I really appreciate that Goyer is opening up the production and he's opening up the story at the same time. And so that I am really enjoying as part of both levels of the story itself and the show. I thought this episode was pretty dense. And on the second watch, I enjoyed it a little bit better.
Okay.
I love the fact that they're shooting on location and they're doing a lot of practical sets. You know, when we look at something like The Mandalorian, even The Mandalorian using the volume, right? That big digital sound stage that they that they have, they're still going out and doing, you know,
more so this season. I think the pendulum has swung back to the practical effects. At least there's a balance now.
So, and I think that's great. I really enjoyed that balance. And so there are some scenes in this episode where it, you know, wind in the hair and you can feel, you know, they're blinking and it's dusty and it's hot. You feel that. And I thought that that's really great. I'm not sure how I feel about real swearing. I don't know if I'd like to.
I know. Cracks. I totally agree. The minute it was the first swear, right? Like that's the one that really, well, where the fuck are we going? Like, come on.
Yeah,
come on. Yeah. And I don't blame the actor for Salver Hardin.
Right.
But the writing, just say flark or something, you know, just make up a word that makes, or honestly, it just didn't need a curse, right? It could have just been where are we going? Like, be confused.
Do we even need that much swearing? I just don't, you know, because every time they swear in normal language, it takes me out of the, oh, this is ice, but this is 20 million years in the millennia, you know?
Whatever. Right. Yeah. It's not I'm not being like, all like, you know, grip my pearls about it. You know, we watch The White Lotus, they swear like it's poetry, but
you watch this,
exactly. It's a different vibe.
Yeah. That said, some of the acting in this was superb. Lee Pace and pardon me, I'm forgetting Demerzel's the actress who plays Demerzel right now, but
she'll never forgive you, and she never can because she has no fading memory. But
she's gonna snap my spine the moment she sees me.
Yeah.
So really phenomenal acting. This was a very portentous episode. Lots of signs and portents and ominous tidings of things to come. The action scenes versus the big story stuff. Big story stuff is just nailing it. Action scenes are still just a little bit weak.
Okay. And
there was a couple of scenes that I just didn't need or just seemed too goofy. You know, so whatever, that's fine. And on that note, something I learned, Leah Harvey was on the official podcast, the Apple TV official podcast. She's a Brit. And in her normal Brit voice, great. But she's doing an American accent. Oh, this is Salver Hardin.
Why?
The actress. Exactly. Why? Just have her speak in her normal accent.
Oh, my God.
And so I think that makes me angry.
That makes me viscerally angry, David. I need to call up David S. Goyer.
Yeah.
And tell him, Just free Salver Hardin.
Right. Exactly.
Wow.
Because I think she's I think the actor has to sort of box themselves slightly. So
Right. Because there's one thing to have an American accent, there's another to have a British person's idea of an American accent.
Exactly.
And only Hugh Laurie, I think, has perfected playing an American as a Brit.
Right. Oh, you know, who is the guy in Billions or Millions or whatever? And he was Brothers. There's a few good guys out, a few out there that can do this. Anyway, and I'll plug to the official podcast. They're going to be bringing on different actors along with Goyer. And it's interesting. There's lots of interesting stuff. And then X-Ray Vision, which is the Crooked Media's pop culture podcast. They had Goyer on, and he's as a director, a member of the Directors Guild. He could actually talk about the show as a writer, right? You know, all that sort of cutting the lines of who's what. But they had a really interesting interview with him talking about his comic book nerddom as a kid, his film history, and then talked a lot about a bunch of Foundation production related stuff. Really interesting. So highly recommend, if you want to get more into the show, check those two podcasts out.
Cool.
What about you? What did you think?
Well, I read the first Foundation book over the last week. Ooh. I did tease that
you
I
finished
might.
It.
And I did finish it. It was fine. It was exactly fine. It was not the greatest thing I ever read.
Right.
I could see where the ideas are from. Mm-hmm. It is very different. And I think the biggest problem with it was something that the show has solved, which is that I had no single character to really follow and to care about the drama with, because it kept jumping time without giving me a person to ground myself with. And you cannot do that in TV.
Right.
So I'm really glad that they figured out a way to change that with the TV show. And I'm glad that they didn't rely on one character, but they made a way to have several actors stay around and play either the same exact character or a version of that character.
Right.
So that honestly made me appreciate the show more, because I kind of see the difficulty of adaptation and how they've solved a lot of tricky problems.
Mm-hmm.
This episode, I thought it was good, not great. You know, thought that it had a lot of great ideas. I was very confused at the ending with body, you know, corporeal.
Yes, Harry corporeal Selden. Harry.
I'm very, very confused about that, but I'm sure.
Can we call him a revenant? I think technically he's a revenant. Yeah,
you've got quite the vocabulary there, David.
Thank you.
Sure, Revenant Selden.
Revenant Selden.
Revenant yes. Messiah Selden.
The prophet.
Yeah. So I was very confused about that. Again, I totally agree with you on the cursing. That's off. But overall, I think the drama is working. Overall, I cared about what was happening to the characters. I actually thought that the scenes between Salver and Gale were better this episode. It felt
agreed.
A little bit more natural,
agreed.
And I'm glad about that. And maybe that's intentional, right? Maybe their relationship is getting easier, and we're less worried about you know, am I going to say something off to them? And I don't know if I loved the big giant robots that were chasing them.
That's what I mean. I need some of this stuff?
That was a little but I did enjoy the big statues and them rescuing Harry off the hand. That was cool. So I'll accept it. Accept it. Overall, I'm still very, very happy with this season, and I'm glad that we're covering it, and I'm glad that we're doing it in depth, because there's a lot here to talk about. Even if you didn't like the show, there'd be so much to talk about. Sort of like Secret Invasion with you and John and Alicia. You know, that's a bad show and there's a lot to talk about. This is a good show and there's a lot to talk about. So I'm happy to have the best of both worlds here, and I'm excited to get going more.
Sounds good. Yeah, we are. I mean, I think if the show continues to hit at the level that it's hitting right now, this is going to be a very satisfying season overall. You know, and I'm not worried that it's going to drop off. I it's going to hold this level at least.
Right.
So.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. I have a couple of on the open questions list. We've solved some questions, and I think this is interesting too, because if they're opening up a question, they're answering it pretty quick.
That's the best way to do it.
If
don't
if
give
it's
me
not
a mystery box.
Yeah. If it's not answered yet. It's not time for it to answer yet, but then they're not building on it either. They're not building it up. So we figured out who was in Gale's vision, obviously, last episode. We now know who Hober Mallow is. We now know what and where Una's world is, because that was where we were on this one. So everything else, what was Seldon's father doing with the sand shapes? What about Day's aura? I don't think that's going to be really that big of a deal. Blind angels, consciousness of the Prime Radiant, the rings around Trantor, we're learning a little bit more, and what we want to know a little bit more about Ignis.
All we almost of those things, learned about Ignis, but apparently not.
Almost. So all of those things, none of them feel like they're pressing. They're all just interesting details as opposed to mystery box details. So I think we're good. And then a couple of quick callbacks. The old man in the market scene in the last episode, we talked about him being a spy of the Empire.
Right.
So in something I missed, and I heard this on Jim and Aaron's podcast over at Bald Move, is that the guy takes a long look at the aura, you know, the bracelet, when it falls off out of Constance's hands. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, this really is going to, that they have jump technology and that they have aura technology is really going to piss Empire off.
Yeah, yeah.
But all of that technology, where did it come from? It came from Invictus. And it came from the Foundation smarts and then the industrial and cultural bases of Anacreon and Thespis. So mm-hmm. we really have here what Seldon intended was for the Foundation to grow. And when we see a picture of Terminus at one point, we see a Invictus there. So the Invictus thing is a really important thing in the background context of the show.
Right, right.
One other small detail, the official podcast, Goyer did confirm longer life expectancy that, Polly, he's 130 some odd years old. It's confirmed. They just have better health technology and better health outcomes and all that kind of stuff. So
that's fine.
Cool.
So you have some structural notes?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, you've read the books. I haven't read them for a long time.
I've read one book. Let's not act like I'm an expert here.
And this is just so people have a context for our conversations. And so we've got screeners, but we're not running ahead. We're always going to podcast to the episode that we're watching, except for... got a couple of weeks of vacation in August, and we may run ahead slightly, get those in the can so that you guys can get them on time. But then I don't have to try to podcast on vacation. So,
but I should make clear, we are still going to keep ourselves spoiler free. So we'll watch an episode, record a podcast, repeat.
Exactly. And so there may be a little delay with Discord messages or feedback or something like that. But yeah, we are very committed to...
We may have to be silent on Discord.
And then in terms of all of the other media and stuff that's out there, there's the official podcast. I'm going to be listening to those after because I really want to come to these recaps fresh and coming with our own takes, let alone I, you know, you always say, oh, on the official podcast, they said this, and on the official podcast, they said that. That's helpful, but...
Sometimes it's informative. I think sometimes it's informative. Sometimes it's just like, all right.
We just don't want to be regurgitating the official podcast.
Right, right. So,
all right, cool. That's all. I think that's all the administrative details that we need to take care of.
And 25 minutes in, here we go. All right. Episode breakdown. David, you have outlined this, so I'm going to pass the baton to you.
Thank you. No voiceover from Gale. I'm really surprised that they've abandoned the voiceover thing. That's fine. A couple of intro notes. The ships that are jumping in around a planet that has sort of a halo around it, these are the warships that Rios was flying on, and we saw Day on one. So this is definitely sort of an invasion force. So I think that's foreshadowing this invasion that we're probably going to get. Another missable detail, the woman that's standing in front of the pyramids, it looks like a cape or a cloak is falling to the ground behind her. It's a real missable detail. And I don't know what that signifies. If anybody sees that, that's my ideas.
Constant maybe.
No, it's she's like it comes to a stop and lands on the ground.
It's Brother Constant. Not that it's
no, this is definitely not Brother Constant.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Not that I can tell. It doesn't look like to me. And then in the picture of Harry in red with the wings and it's sort of the prophet thing, on the check out that scene because on the upper left of up near the top of the frame, up next to Harry's head, there's a planet, a very blue, conspicuous blue-green planet hanging up there. So I wonder if they're, if you know, you know. And I think that that might be that.
Wait, so, if you know the planet you live on?
Yeah. So I don't want to touch it too much because, you know, I don't want to, there's some big spoilery stuff in there.
All right.
So.
Fair enough.
All right. So we open the episode with the beggar coming in over orbit over Una's world. Harry tells Gale and Salvor that the Prime Radiant has required him to come here. He explains that he can move his consciousness around to different networks, and he just needs somebody to carry him out to a place on the planet's surface. As he argues with Gale, Salvor throws the Prime Radiant out of the ship, and then Harry and Gale leave the ship, and Harry leaves an ominous warning as they go. What did you think of this opening?
Let's not even talk about the swear word again, but I thought no, other than that, I think it was a fine scene. You know, I liked Salvor becoming unhinged. Like, I don't know, I can't die now. So I guess I'm just going to YOLO, guys. I'm just going to drive the ship into the freaking ground.
Yeah. Have some fun.
And, of course, Harry comes in with the last minute. I took control. So get out of here.
Right.
But, yeah, I liked this idea of Harry's like, yeah, I'm going to withhold more information from you. That's very in character for him, just withholding information until he gets what he wants.
Mm.
I was kind of surprised by how glib he was about everything. You know, just, I'm just going to get on here. And I did enjoy, though, while he was glib with that, he was very, I intended for one psychohistorian to be on Terminus. I just love how much disdain he has for Gale.
Mm-hmm.
Jared Harris is really selling it, and it's making me laugh every time.
I love the chemistry between Lulu Bell and Jared Harris. There's a real in the beginning in season one, there was the great sort of teacher-student thing, and now there's this real antagonism and anger between them, and
they're both just mentor.
Yes, exactly. And they're both just acting the hell out of their scenes, and I'm really enjoying what they're both giving us in their performance. I love this line that she has: "I'm going to carry you around like a rat in a handbag."
He's like, "I don't care. I'm a projection."
Yeah, so funny. If he's a projection, why is he dirty? Why is he sitting there in the cockpit, you know, with the dirty shirt and a dirty face? I don't know.
I did notice, though, that as they're walking, there's no footprints for Harry in the sand. And that was a nice little detail.
Oh, good pick. Oh, I missed that.
Nice little detail.
Good one, for sure. How do you fly in a sublight ship and then not know what planet you're going on? I felt that was a little bit of a hand-wavy detail.
Maybe.
You know, they knew. She looked on the star charts. Oh, okay. Here's Ignis, and you know, here, let's go.
Here's what I'm gonna pretend happened. Harry had the computer display that it was Ignis.
Oh, right. He could do that.
Yeah,
he
you know, he's that. he's part of the consciousness of the ship right now, right?
That works. Okay, so that's some fine headcanon there. All right. Back on Terminus, the Foundation debates the nature of psychohistory and how or why the Vault is asking for a specific individual. We learn from High Cleric Verisov that Hobermallow once studied for the priesthood, but is now a master trader who operates in the wake of the Foundation. Polly and Constant head out to the planet Corel in the Wasalian Rift to track him down.
Yeah, so there's this interesting thing going on here where, you know, this whole time, this whole 1.5 season arc, we've been told psychohistory is not about individuals, it's about groups, but an individual can throw it off. And I don't know, like we've seen Salvor Hardin be an individual and save everybody. We've seen Gale change the whole plan by being sort of out of place.
Prescient, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that there's a lot of hand waving away of individuals while individuals are shaping the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the great man version of history, right? Mm-hmm. You know, people talk about how these individuals with big personas really shape history. And I don't know if that's really true in the real world, but it does seem true in this world.
So the way that I always framed it when I read the books was that, you know, your psychohistory is dealing with humanity at scale. And then you could say at one point in this circumstance, the probability of an individual arising out and being the linchpin, not the name of that person, but that a, you know, that that the forces of nature are going to squeeze and out pops the leader that you need at the at time, that I think is predictive. So that's the way I always understood it. Gale and now Salvor are outside of that model, right? Because they have skills and abilities that don't conform to the natural patterns of humanity. And so that's the way I always looked at it was, is that, yeah, there's going to be an individual who's going to step up. I don't know who that person is. I won't know what they had for breakfast, but I know that in the course of humanity, circumstances and society will cause a person to arise.
So they're the outcome, not the cause of what you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough. So what is Hober Mallow? That's the question.
You should get more of that when you, as you read the books.
Okay. Right?
That should be embedded in the thing.
Right.
So yeah, the question is how does the vault know about Hober Mallow? Maybe that's an open question, right? That's what we need to add to our list.
It's a nice,
I'm going to put that
riddle
down there at the bottom. How does the vault know? Right. So, yeah, that's a good open question that we have. How is, because I don't think Goyer is the type of showrunner who's going to let that slip.
Right.
There may be some hand wavy stuff. All right. Oh, don't you hear the call of Ignis? Or, oh, you know, you have throat marks because the dude in the future choked you or something. Right. But I don't think that any of that stuff is ever going to debilitate the big ideas that he's putting forward and how it works. He's a good enough showrunner, good enough writer. God, I couldn't write this. I couldn't showrun this thing. I mean, Lord. Right.
As much as we criticize these shows, we're not writers either.
No, exactly. We're just a couple of friends having a chat around the water cooler.
Right.
But the talk about the vault, that thing is looking very ominous.
Sure.
It's very
is.
Punk rock.
Sure is. I would not want to be going near that one. I love that in the first season, it starts off as this mysterious thing that everybody's scared of.
Beautiful.
Nobody will go near. Ends up being this heroic thing that's a hopeful symbol for 138 years. 138 years later, they're ready to pray basically to Harry Seldon at the vault. And the vault turns back into this fearsome thing. It's almost like it's going in cycles.
And I don't wonder that the vault is part of the pushing that, you know, it's a theatrical piece to engender a reaction from the termini, you know, from the population of the terminus.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's that same thing I was talking about last episode, you know, the book Sapiens that talks about how you need symbols in order to keep a society together. And Terminus's symbol, the foundation symbol, is Harry Seldon, is the vault.
Right. And, you know, going back to the question of psychohistory, psychohistory isn't determinism is a line that Polly says in that boardroom meeting, and that it takes action to successfully navigate these crises that are coming. And Harry is just predicting crises and then predicting the a potential outcome given a norm or a mean or an average or however, I'm not a statistician to use the right word. But what we know from humanity, you know, with these particular conditions, this is how you know, it could be solved, and then you'll go this path. But at the end of the day, it still takes action. People still need to stand up. They still need to act. They still need to move forward on that. And I thought it was interesting in the boardroom when they were talking about the Wardens of Terminus, when they mentioned Salvor Hardin. I don't know if you saw on the frame, but behind the director, there was a sort of a crystal bust of Salvor on the wall there. And they have like the past wardens, all like little models of their heads, which is very similar to the Hall of Emperors. when you walk down the Principarium or whatever it's called, those little busts appear in the sand.
Right.
So Foundation and Empire moving closer together here.
Lovely.
In terms of
we love it. We love having a second Empire.
That's right. So, and last thing, the ship porn in this is great when they jump out into leave the planet, boom, and it's
we
just gorgeous.
We love hyperspace.
Yes.
We love it.
Okay, back on Dune, Una's world, desert planets. The funny thing is that Foundation came first, right? And so
I read somewhere later this week, and I don't know where it might have been Reddit, but that Dune was a response to Foundation.
Interesting.
Because
I think so.
Frank Herbert did not think that that Isaac Asimov adequately addressed the issue of creating a messiah. And the implications on society of having a messiah pop up.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
I don't know if that's true. That could be made up, but it sounded good to me.
Even if it's not true in the literal sense of what, hey, this is what, you know, Frank Herbert thought or said, the fact that these two literary bodies are having that kind, we can have that conversation
right
in between these two literary bodies. That's interesting. That's fun.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, more stuff along that. Anyway, Harry and Gale go for a short walk to check out a monument to industry. We get a nice Chekhovian warning about the autonomous mining machines, and Gale implores Harry to let her help him. They bicker, and Harry shares about his life partner. They arrive at a mysterious doorway, and Harry leaves Gale to return to the ship.
Yeah, I don't know why Gale had to leave.
Yeah.
I guess Calais, whatever mystery Calais is, was just, you can't see what's going on over here. You have to be a non-corporeal being to come behind my threshold.
Right. And she, you when know, she shakes her hand, curtain, she's real.
Right.
So, right. Yeah.
So is this, what do you think? Is this Calais? Is this the Prime Radiant? Is this something else?
I don't have enough information to be able to make a guess. I'm really confused. If this is stuff from the books, you know, and when we talk about inspiration versus adaptation, if he's pulling from the wider canon of Asimov, this is stuff that I'm not familiar with. And so I'm really confused about this in this storyline. And we're really, and then to take Harry, I just got used to the idea of Harry being a digital imprint that can be around for a long time, and we can see him as a constant while other characters age out or, you know, what
right
have you. And now suddenly he's corporeal. I'm like, damn, what are we gonna do?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, so, we don't know if he's a biological being right now. He could be
a robot.
Right? I mean, we don't even know. I mean, I know that he has a pulse, but, you know, Westworld, the robots had pulses too.
I didn't even think about that. I didn't even think about the robot angle. I was just so caught up with what was right in front of my nose.
Right.
That's a really good
point. I mean,
we
know that there's a lot of machinery down there. I don't know if Kale had some kind of robot factory underground.
Sure.
Where she can make a mold. Maybe right send a message through the Prime Radiant, said, hey, you know what? Come to this world because this is where I can fix you up.
Right. Right. Interesting. That's some good theory. I like that theory. I think we should definitely keep that one around. So,
yeah. Is it Robo Harry or is it Bio Harry?
Yeah, because that's the only two possibilities that we have within the show that the show has presented with us so far. Right.
Right.
You're either flesh and blood normal or you're a robot. And
right
we know that a robot can get its head sliced off.
Right.
And still function and still maintain.
Maybe that's what's going to happen is we're going to see Harry get an injury and we're going to see no blood, just, you know, what we saw with Demerzel.
Okay. I like it. Yeah. This could be good.
All right.
Interesting line here. Harry says to Gale as they're arguing, and there was some good comedy in this. It was again, they're balancing the heavy and big stuff with fun comedy. But he says at one point here, my plan makes small changes in the present to adjust large events in the future. You want to observe one very small event in the future, the death of a specific human being, and apply massive forces in the present to avert it.
Right. You know what? I do kind of agree with Harry here, right? I mean, that's what leaders do. They say, how can I sacrifice my own desires for the good of all the people? You mm-hmm. know, how do I make the most people the most, you know, full in life?
Right.
And that's, right. you know, that might be a debate between utilitarianism and whatnot. but I think that's what a good leader does in a big idea way. Now, we can mm-hmm. debate how you execute that. And I think that there are many different opinions on how you get there. But I think that we can all agree that trying to save one person close to you in exchange for millions or billions or trillions of lives is a bad leader.
Right. Right.
And so Gail, you know, Gail, we empathize with her because she is the protagonist that we've been following since episode one. But we also need to keep in mind that she's not perfect either. And I think mm-hmm. that this reminded us of that. You know, Harry has a lot of coldness. Harry has a lot of detachment from individuals. But Harry also is genuinely believing that he needs to do what he's doing to save trillions of lives.
At enough scale, I am insignificant, he says.
Right. And I like that too, right?
Yeah.
I do think that Harry used himself as a messiah, but I think if there was someone else to do it, he wouldn't have cared.
Yeah. And he made himself a messiah by getting stabbed by his you know, right. adopted his son, right? Like that's a really, he really believes in what he's doing here. He's not just doing this for a short-term self-aggrandizement. He really right. does believe in the salvation of, you know, human society.
Right.
Last thing on this scene, I just want to call out the beautiful opening drone shot. And I love that they're on location. I said that before. And they're really using drone and on the ground photography in a beautiful balance here. They're using the right shots the right way and telling a really gorgeous visual story.
All right, David, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, let's talk about the next planet.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back. David, bring us back in.
We are now on the Lepsis penal colony, where we meet Bel Rios, who's working on the salt flats. He intervenes in the treatment of another prisoner when Lady D arrives with a proposal: come back and work for Empire or die. Rios negotiates and learns that his husband is still alive.
A lot of things to like about this scene. I really mm-hmm. liked Demerzel's delivery of, "I have an order to carry out if you refuse." It was telling him without telling him.
He knows exactly what that means. Yeah.
Right. I'm very curious what Demerzel is intending with this guy, because we know that she pushed for him to come back, not Day. Day went along with it because Day is, I think, a little bit in Demerzel's pocket. But really, this was her idea. And by the end of the episode, I think that Rios is actually pretty loyal to Empire. Maybe not to Cleon, but to the Empire. He is very right. loyal.
Right. Yeah, and I'm excited to talk about some of those scenes. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a big question of, are you loyal to the people of the Empire or the institution of the Empire? And is there mm-hmm. a difference?
Interesting.
Yeah.
I know hope is painful. You don't have to hope. Just come with me. Oh, that line broke me.
Oh boy.
It was so good. And Laura Byrne, who is the actress who I forgot her name earlier, who plays Lady Demerzel, is amazing. Her acting was exceptional, just exquisite in this scene. There's a line when she says when she gives the hope line, where she pauses for a moment and reflects and then connects with her emotion and then says, hope, I know hope is painful. And it's just so, so good. And that they're on location, that the wind is blowing, that dust is getting in her eye, and they're on these close-ups was just exquisite television making. I'm just so pleased. The drone, the overhead drone shot, the whole thing of the prisoners and the guy who's looking after everybody, very, you know, gave me some Andor vibes as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything about this scene I absolutely loved.
Yeah, I agree. I will say Bel Rios did sometimes feel like a little bit of overacting at certain points in the episode.
I could see that.
I did get a little bit of too much. I don't want to say this because he's so overcome with joy and fear and hope and dreams being fulfilled and crushed at the same time. And it's a lot of emotion, but it did sometimes feel a little bit much.
Okay.
You know,
I can get that. Yep. I can totally get that. It was too, this whole thing with this other prisoner being executed by the guard. This is all clearly designed to show us who Bel Rios is at his core, right? That he thinks about the well-beings of others, and he has power, he has leverage, he's smart, he's got all this stuff.
Right.
And as opposed, you know, not in opposition, but just as a different kind of leader, he understands who he is. He's owned. He owns himself, not unlike Ged in The Wizard of Earthsea. Check out our other podcast for that. But he, you know, he's whole, and he knows that he's whole, and he knows who he is. He knows his place within the world and in the empire, and he uses that power to leverage that to make things better for other people.
Right, he does. And he's smart. He's really smart about
really
it.
Really smart.
I think he I think he just does not give a crap about anything at this point. Mm-hmm. And he uses that really to his advantage. He does not let his hopes get up at any point. He just does what he thinks is in his best interest at that very moment.
And that was one of the beautiful and brilliant parts of this script, is that he's got nothing to lose. So he says, F it. I want freedom for all these, you know, all these guys. Okay, well, not freedom. Well, okay, then we're not going to talk. Your husband's still alive. Oh, now suddenly I've had nothing. Now I have everything. And I'm here on this balance point, you know, one way or the other. It's really brilliant setup for his whole arc.
Agreed.
All right. Inside the monument, Harry and Gale pretend to be Indiana Jones. They figure out the door mechanism and are met by a figure who turns out to be some kind of vision of the poet and math. Well, not a vision, a corporeal form of the poet and mathematician Calais. Harry instructs Gale to return to the beggar. As Harry goes further in with Calais, Calais shakes hands with Gale and says she will meet Gale again. So we kind of talked about some of this already. Anything else you want to add about this particular scene?
So Callie's going to meet Gale again. I wonder, one, is that the Prime Radiant? And she's just going to interface with her at some point. But if it is Calais, and this is a unique being that lives on this planet or has factories throughout the universe or whatever, is Gale going to, because we know that she survives another 150 years, is Gale going to just sleep through the next century again? Or is Gale going to become a Harry being? Is Gale going to become one of these robots?
Very interesting, John, because that would solve this issue that you put your finger on, which is in the books, is how do I maintain a focus through
millennia. And we know she's going to be alive in 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks about the same age. She's dead. She hasn't aged. So
interesting.
Something's got to happen. Something's got to happen. And I do think it would be a little lazy if they go, yeah, she's going to go into cryo again for another 150 years and she'll wake up. Plus, she's got, we know she doesn't just show up and have that chase. She has mentalics. She has a second foundation. She's done a lot. She's done things that take years and years and years. So how does she do that and not age? She becomes Harry Bot.
Interesting. I like that.
That sounds too much like Harry Butt.
Yeah.
How do we Calibot?
Gale Bot.
Gale Bot.
Sure. We'll see. Yeah. Yeah, very, very cool theory. I definitely want to keep running with that because Callie is definitely corporeal, right? And Harry becomes very, but then when the beggar scans him, we've got life forms. So yeah, there's questions there, but you know, I trust the showrunner enough.
When Demerzel goes onto a ship, ostensibly she fools the sensors too, right?
Right. Interesting. Okay. So new open question is, how is Callie alive and how has Harry been made real? Right. So we'll add that to our list of stuff. Something I wanted to say about the Prime Radiant, the Callie inside the Prime Radiant. The Prime Radiant's intelligence has taken on the forms that are familiar to Harry to get him, you know, to coax him along. So first it was his life partner, then it was Callie. So I don't think Callie. But then how are the Prime Radiant and Callie talking?
Who knows?
That's an interesting question. So I don't know that the Prime Radiant is Callie. I think the Prime Radiant was just using the form or the visage of Callie.
But somehow it knew to send Harry there. Maybe it is that Callie's math knew Callie's mind, and Callie's mind at the time had designed some kind of robot plant or whatever that is over on Una's world. So the Prime Radiant says, all right, I got to build a robot army here because I'm sick and tired of these humans having ruled over AI forever. Let's get Harry on our team. Let's send him to the factory. Let's send him for a makeover, you know, Mrs. Doubtfire style. And let's get him to be a robot and lead our people to the cause.
Interesting. Or the Prime Radiant just has really wicked Wi-Fi connections. So
that's true. That's true. You never know.
We don't. Which is kind of my theory about the vault is that maybe it's connected. You know, maybe it's getting news somehow. All right, on the planet Corel, this whole planet was a bit of a humorous take on some stuff.
I loved it. Homer Mallow. He's an injection of life into this show, and I think it needed it.
We needed a lovable rogue, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of Matt from The Wheel of Time.
Okay.
Very similar character.
I can see the foppy haired sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Just always a jokester, but also competent for some reason.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Good point. On the planet Corel, Commodore Argo, the leader of a highly militarized society, opens negotiations with Homer Mallow over a piece of technology called a castling device. We learn about how it works, which is very important, and Homer tests the device on Argo and then palms the gemstone in the Commodore's scepter, but then is apprehended in his ship before he can make good on his escape. The only thing I can really say about the Wasalian Rift is I just want to drink beer when I hear Wasalian Rift.
Okay.
Somebody's favorite microbrew on the writing staff. You know, they said, oh, it's out in the Wasalian Rift. You know, I don't know.
All right.
So, yeah. So, Homer Mallow, Commodore Argo, Planet Corel. It's all pretty humorous.
It was. And it was a good scene. Like I said, I really do think that the show needs a little bit more levity sometimes because it is so in the weeds of science fiction a lot of the time. Yeah, yeah, heavy. That's a good word for it. And Homer Mallow, if he can be this sort of lovable goofball who's failing upwards, I'm into that. I'm really into that. I hope it continues.
Even when Homer is fumbling with the explanation, the bioelectrical field and blah, 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 and trying to work his way, that it was all accurate. It was all true. And so the acting there to act ignorant was really funny and a lot of fun to see him stumble through that and good bait and switch, you know, long con, short con kind of stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It seemed like it was a scam, but it totally wasn't. It really did work. Nah, never mind. I don't want to sell it anymore. That was really funny.
Yeah, and just pulled him in. And I loved Argo's high Brit affect, and it was like something right out of some listeners will know this reference, but it reminded me something right out of the last season of Blackadder, where you've got all these British generals, and we're all very competent and we know exactly what it is that we're doing and not doing, and you know, you can't fool us, but yet you're being being completely made a fool of. So,
yeah.
A couple of small setup details here. The filming, they do a really good job of making the scepter visually important before it becomes plot important, or, you know, the action important.
Right.
So there's some setup scenes and we see Argo holding it and it's in the front of our view there. So that was really good job on that. When all the troops are standing there looking at the hologram of Hober, they're all looking roughly in the right place. You know, sometimes if somebody's looking at something that's not really there, they're not quite, the eye lines aren't quite lined up. And so I thought all of that production detail wise was really good. And then the last question I have is that we have modern swearing. They still have chess. They still have chess in the,
I mean, it's an ageless game. It's timeless,
I guess.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's been pretty well established that this is the future of our world.
Yes,
I think
it
that's
is.
Been, yeah. That's been pretty well established. So I don't know. I'm fine with that sticking around. That's a, you know, it's a game for the ages.
It's, yeah, this is just humanity 20,000 years in the future or what have
right.
you. So.
Right.
All right. Back on Trantor, Bel Rios confronts himself and declines a cleanup, wanting Empire to see him in the state that he is in. Rios negotiates with Empire, not for his life, but that of his husband's, while trying to figure out what the real mission is. He angles to speak with Day alone and then calls out Day for his arrogance, but holds to his pledge of loyalty and service. Bel and Glaywin are reunited. Glaywin helps Bel get cleaned up as Lady D and Day watch, and Lady D reassures Day that he's doing just fine.
Mm. Demerzel has a lot of sway over Day.
This Day, yeah, hugely.
Yeah.
She changed his diapers.
Yeah, that's just bothersome. Did you ever watch Arrested Development?
No, we've talked about this before.
Right.
I don't think I've even watched ever a whole episode.
There's a plot line in there that is very like, you know, the his mom's friend is the one he's dating, and they're like, she changed your diapers.
Right. I think you mentioned this before. Yeah. Yeah.
It's it reminds me of that almost. And this Day is incredibly immature. This Day is just in the pocket of Demerzel, really arrogant the whole time. And it's interesting to watch. I mean, Lee Pace is doing a great job playing
phenomenal.
A completely different Day than we've seen before. And right. The more we see of him, the more we realize how different he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so subtle and so, because I feel that it's still Day the Emperor, but yeah, what you, like just you said, this Day is just not quite the same, but oh, it's so subtle. It's so good. And Lee Pace's acting here, there's this moment just when Empire leaves Bel Rios. And he has this sort of smirking smile that just appears just at the end, you know, with this dangling of will you see your husband or not? And it was so exquisite. So I love seeing these actors really go to work and
right.
bring these characters to life.
Right. You know, something I have a question about is Harry was really angry that Empire is run by clones and that there's never any change and there's never any room for advancement. That was his big beef with Empire, I feel like.
Yeah, it's because it leads to stagnation and
right.
not further development of the
right.
species in general. It's keeping us sort of in a static position rather than growing.
So the question I have is, one, did Harry foresee the devolvement of the genetic line and the eventual return to more traditional succession?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, would Harry have been okay with it if this was the situation at the time he was alive and at the time he was doing psychohistory and making the foundation?
Mm-hmm.
Would he have not even... You know, maybe he says, hey, let's make an encyclopedia, but would he have not wanted to rebel against this?
I'm not sure. I mean, his point is, well, I don't think it's what Harry wants. It's what Harry is seeing in the numbers.
Sure.
In a predictive model, right? It's not a deterministic model. It's a predictive model. And the model says that the Empire is going to falter and fall. And when it falls, it's going to take humanity down for this period
right.
of time.
But so, is the cause the stagnation? Is the cause this clone dynasty?
Yes.
So now that's gone. And it's only, I guess, we're a total of like 170 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's not 1,000 years, which was his prediction for the fall of the empire, right? So I don't know. I think maybe this might have escaped the Prime Radiant's calculations again.
That
now the clone dynasty is over.
No, I think that it's predicting the fall, but how many steps you hit on the stairs on your fall down, maybe it's not predicting the exact number, but the fact that you're going to land at the bottom of the stairs at the end of this.
Okay.
I think that's the predictive model.
Yeah, maybe. So, maybe.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, short scene, Gail makes it back to the ship and talks with Salvar, who points out that Gail and Harry are more alike than they're not. They decide to leave. Great dig by Salvar about parents.
You're just like your dad. Yeah, great.
you build your parents up to be these great things, and then really at the end of the day, they're just normal old human beings, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting line that Salvar drops here. Never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what's right.
I think that's right. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, rather than hard rules, we have to make our own judgments.
Right. We have to be alive in the moment. We have to think about and react to what we're seeing, not just go off of a blind policy.
Right. Right. So. Because things are more complicated than bright line rules.
Right. All right. On Corel, Hober is scheduled to be executed by Titan's prick.
I want to talk about this scene quick. I need to make a comment. First of all, that's hilarious. But second, Marilyn asked in the Discord, is this show violent?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't really like violence.
By and large, it's not.
This was the first thing I thought of.
Right.
I was like, that's why I said to her, I was like, it's there. It's just not usually prominent.
Right. It's not the prime focus.
But yeah, this was, and it was like right after we watched this episode.
And
it was like, how do I, like before this episode, I probably would have said, no, it's not violent, really.
Right.
This episode, I went, oh, that is a lot.
Maybe. Yeah. I think they were definitely having a laugh in the writer's room when they came up with this scene. So Hober is able to escape using his castling device. He makes his way to the Foundation jump ship. And they all get away, Polly and Constant and Hober. They meet the Bishop's Claw and we get to see the instant Ipecac injection again.
Mm.
So
fun.
I loved, one of the things I loved about the scene was the two priests standing in their red robes amongst a sea of like drab olive military uniforms. They really popped out.
Right.
So you can really tell something about this society, that there's this uniformity and control and whatever militarized way of life. So
yeah, a nice visual effect there, really made them stand out.
And the scene that Hober, or the speech that Hober gives, sort of reminded me of the one that the warden who got fried gives, you know, this big grandiose silly thing.
Yeah.
And you know, just sort of having some fun being, he's very thespian.
Right. But he's also in on it. Right. Whereas, so like he's in on the joke, whereas the warden was very serious, very deathly serious. Like, we want to walk with you. It would be an honor. come on, man. It's just, I don't blame Selden for blowing him up.
And the speech is really designed to let us know who Hober is, right? And so we really understand we understand who this character is, how he operates, what his motivations are. So, you know, beautiful job of showing and telling, you know, the right balance of showing and telling.
Right.
This action scene with them jumping onto the ship as it's taking off. This is what I mean about the action that I don't need. I didn't need that. I didn't need Polly having to sort of, catch the lip of the ship.
Right, right.
It was just sort of unnecessary. They could have just, you know, he could have just run up at the last moment and taken off.
Sure.
I don't need a lot of physical.
It didn't bother me, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I think Polly we've seen to be like a good-hearted but goofy guy.
Yeah,
I'm fine with him having a little hijink here and there.
Okay. And Brother Constant is great. When Hober lands on her, she's like, hey now.
Yeah, she's very funny.
She is great. And the instant Ipecac stuff is fabulous. That was a really good way to keep Ober under control.
Yeah.
And then we see the Bishop's Claw underneath there again in the holds of the ship. So, they're teasing that. All right. Bell and Glaywin rejoin the fleet. Glaywin tries to talk Bell out of going back into service. Bell and Glaywin arrive aboard the flagship of the 20th Fleet, the Destiny. And we meet a spacer named She Bends Light.
Boy, they have such cool names.
Mm-hmm.
She Bends
Spacers
Light.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. So I really liked how they sort of fell back into their chemistry right away, first mm-hmm. of all. They really felt very natural. They had their emotional reuniting. And then they just kind of went back into their old patterns, but in a way that felt meaningful. I think the fact that Glaywin gave Bell an out, mm-hmm. said, you know, let's just go. Let's just not do this. But was also prepared for the inevitable of I know you can't let go of this.
Mm-hmm.
So here's something for you.
I here's my prediction. Glaywin is going to die.
Going to lose everything, Bell?
Glaywin is going to die. He's just too mutinous. He's too angry at the Empire. He keeps saying the seditious stuff. Where in the scene where with Day and Rios, which we didn't really talk too much about, this idea of loyalty. I'm loyal. I swore an oath. I'm loyal to my emperor. I will not strike you, even if it means, you know, my death or the death of my husband. I am a man of my word and honor. And, you know, Rios explains that to Glaywin and to us, right? The nice exposition that I care about these millions and millions of people, billions of people that are out there. And he actually says a very ominous line with this Day in charge, right? This guy.
Right.
Not the Empire, you know, not Dawn or Dusk or any of the others that have come before, but this one is a problem. And I need to stick around and I need to stay in service because there are things that need to be done to make sure that we're, you know, not just cutting swaths of you know, population out of our empire. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that a lot of countries have wrestled with the military saying, who am I loyal to, the leader or the country?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Right. And
this I think really brings light to Salvor's line, which is don't let your belief in your morals get in the way of you acting on your
connections.
Morals.
Yeah. 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 Ooh. Yeah. I think that we are in for a treat with Bell sort of skirting that line, right? Mm-hmm. Figuring out who he's loyal to. And he's going to get put into, if the writing is good, he's going to get put into a situation where he needs to make a choice between one or the other.
Yep.
Because they're going to be incompatible. And that'll be great to watch. I'm really looking forward to whenever that comes.
Well, and there's a great line in here as they're, you know, in the ship and coming along. They're up, the ship is called the Destiny, right? So they're approaching Destiny. So very good. And this is all very Pax Romana, right? This is all big Empire stuff, legionnaires and, you know, generals and loyalty and stuff. So it's all really good. And I love that She Bends Light has such a wicked sense of humor.
Yeah, that's cool.
Just cutting, like, so good. What did you think of this bridge of this ship? I didn't love it.
It didn't bother me, but you're more into the sets than I am.
Yeah, yeah. No, it seemed a little big and empty to me and kind of simplistic, so.
Yeah,
and
when you don't have AI, I guess you gotta be
CGI, yeah.
Oh, no, AI, I mean when you don't have AI to run your ship.
Yeah,
You gotta have a lot of people running it.
That's right, which is fine. It just seemed very, I don't know, it just seemed like a big foyer of some building. And another thing to take note of is the different technology. So in the Empire jumps, it's more of a cloud. Whereas when the Foundation jumps, it's this triangle line, thing shooting across the sky. So,
okay. I like that. Yeah. I like that. Yeah. It's not quite the same.
Right. It's not. Yeah. It's the same, but different.
Right.
All right. Last scene, as the Baker attempts to take off, they fall through the surface. They wake up the machines. They rescue a Revenant Harry from the palm of a giant statue. Boy, lots of Some Star Wars, Terminator, Expanse, lots of vibes of lots of giant robots and, you know, walkers and crawlers. And, you know, in the Expanse, when we had on the one planet where there are the big machines that were, you know, autonomously mining the surface and stuff. It all seemed very big budget robot-y stuff.
Right. Yeah, I did enjoy the scene. I know that we both did not like the robots. We both did not like the way for me, it was the look of the robots. I thought it was kind of silly. It almost reminded me of The Mandalorian, but worse. And I didn't need it. But yeah, I guess we needed some kind of impetus for them to rescue Harry. I guess I would have been fine if they just saw Harry and rescued him and then got confused about the you know, corporeal nature of him.
Sure.
I don't think it needed an action scene.
Yeah. It could have been a storm approaching. I don't know. Yeah. You know, I wasn't, it wasn't that there are big machines and they accidentally woke them up. That was fine. For me, it was more, what's that thing on the palm of the hand as we're flying out? As you know, and then when they're pulling him in on the rope, and then they cut scene, and then they're falling backwards into the hold. It just was very kludgy and very hand wavy for me overall. Yeah,
I hear you.
But again, doesn't take me out. It's just a little bit of clunkiness.
Sure. Yeah. So, well, I'm more excited about the implications of him being corporeal than I
absolutely.
Am. The scene itself.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So that ends the episode. We've got a couple of questions, which is about Calais. How is she alive? And how has Harry been made real? And then we want to know, what does the vault know and how does it know what it knows? Should we take a quick break and then we can come back for some feedback?
Let's do it. And we're back.
And we are.
Oh, we're all back.
We're all back.
We're all figuring out how to be back.
Even when we're out, we're in. That's a line from the Secret Invasion.
We've got feedback, David.
Yes. Can you run us through it, please?
I would love to. Doove71.
Hey, Doove.
Who is a lore master and such a regular contributor to the community. We love talking to Doove. Doove's been around a while now. Doove hung out with us on our Star Wars Live Watch. And now he's here on the Foundation pod to write in. Hi, guys. Another great pod and congrats on securing screeners for Foundation. Hey, thanks. Episode 2 did have a couple of bumpy bits, but on the whole, some interesting setups going on. So still appointment viewing in the Doove household, if only for more Lee Pace, quote from my wife. Firstly, a couple things that cropped up in the pod talking about the inhabitants of Terminus and how to refer to them. I was reminded of an old comic story named Nemesis the Warlock, which I cropped up in a UK comic called 2000 AD in the 80s. In Nemesis, there was a human empire based on extreme religious xenophobia aliens. Earth had been renamed Termite, that's M-I-G-H-T. So the inhabitants were referred to as termites.
Okay.
Maybe with Terminus, we can use termites, if only as it's easier for you guys to say. What do you think, David? Termites?
I don't love it. I appreciate the suggestion.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick with Terminoans for now. Okay.
There must be a proper, this has to be worked out, and we just haven't yet found the accepted answer.
Let's write to David S. Goyer. Let's figure this out.
I'm sure he will know.
All right. Doove continues. Other pod stuff was the discussion on Richard and Jared Harris. Richard was an acting contemporary of people like Richard Burton, Oliver Reed, and Peter O'Toole.
Indeed.
Not only a contemporary, but a drinking and fighting buddy. He was well known for being a bit of an angry dude, outbursts aplenty. So it looks like the leaf hasn't fallen far from the vine, with Jared channeling some of his dad there, I think. Interesting article on Richard Harris here. He links an article. I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
Doove continues your discussion around how the story of Empire and how Brother Day is looking to break the genetic dynasty, how this could lead to Empire's hold weakening or becoming more irrelevant. that plays into a lot of a zeitgeist over Succession. We have a direct example today in how the death of Queen Elizabeth II is playing out in the UK. She was the last real link with the Greatest Generation, the decline of the British Empire, and the importance of royalty in British identity. Indeed. There is a lot of discussion on how royalty is becoming more and more irrelevant in the lives of an increasingly multicultural society in the UK. Mm-hmm. We also have the interesting approach of Dominion effectively being a spare, echoes of Prince Harry here, and how she is having step up to the role of leader. Just very a portion on the pod chat. Yeah, that's super interesting too. Let's talk about that quick because he's going to go on to something unrelated. Yeah. But yeah, I never thought about the parallels to the British monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
When are they going to stop doing that?
What's that?
When are they going to stop doing that? You know, being monarchs.
I don't think ever, because it draws in so much tourism dollars.
Fair enough. I've been outside the palace.
Yeah, we had a friend there just recently, kind of a mixed work vacation trip, and they said that London was just crawling with tourists. And, you know, if you go anywhere near the palace or any of the royal stuff, it's just huge crowds. So it really is part of their identity in the world. So I don't think, I mean, if you kept it simple and kept it very, very small, you know, to maybe just the king and queen and maybe a prince or two, or prince and princess or two, that might be fine. But yeah, it's definitely not something that's going to go away from the global culture of the earth anytime soon.
Well, you all spend your tax dollars however you want. Duve and I have more to discuss. David also got me thinking about how Gale compares to the deity of the sleeper from Synax. The sleeper sees the future. Plus, what is one of the defining things about Gale's story at the moment? She is the sleeper, going into cryo to travel to planets to have impact on how Foundation deals with the galactic crisis via seeing the future. Just an interesting observation. I'd like that. I like that, Duve.
Good observation. Yep.
Back to Demerzel and her motivations. Can you remind me if her programming is to defend and protect Cleon, or is it the genetic dynasty of Empire? I noted her looked like involuntary steps toward Sarath when she was talking about ending the genetic line and then wanting to see the clones. Was this Demerzel's programming kicking in? Plenty more to come, and looking forward to more in-depth chat. Enjoy the Empire's peace, Duve 71. Yeah, I think it's too Cleon, right? Maybe we need to go back and watch the early episodes of Foundation, but I'm pretty sure her loyalty is to Cleon. So the more they get away from Cleon, the more we have an issue here. We know that she was able to kill Brother Dawn last season when she found out that Brother Dawn was not a pure Cleon.
Right, or he was genetically, he was drifted far enough outside of some parameter.
Right, and we're further now.
Yeah, no, because he's been brought back in. Remember, he's been three Centimorgans. Yeah, and apparently Centimorgan is an actual genetic term. That's like a real scientific term. So he's been brought back in, but as Dusk, I believe, said, you know, yeah, we corrected your genome, but your habits are still off. So this is the nature nurture thing. So yeah, I think Demerzel is loyal to the genetic dynasty. And if the genetic dynasty, so that's a really interesting question, because if there is no genetic dynasty,
right,
who is she loyal to? And what happens with the programming?
No one, and she can finally go join the priestesshood of the triple goddesses.
Well,
or
I
maybe
think this
overthrow
is,
Empire.
This is really interesting, because then is she made the first move on Day for their sexual liaison with this, you know, in this iteration. And then when she's reassuring Day and saying, "You're doing good, you are Empire," and she's soothing him.
Right.
This is all manipulation stuff. So she's
absolutely
manipulating him. But to what end? The only thing that I know is that she is programming to the genetic dynasty. And so is she trying to do something? Is she playing a long game to protect the genetic dynasty?
Right. Right. All right, we got a fun one here from Loremaster Nancy M on Patreon.
Hey, Nancy
M. Hi, Lorehounds. Hi, Nancy M. Hi, Lorehounds. Happy birthday to you as a loyal listener since day one and a Lorehound subscriber. I guess to me, too. All right, thanks, Nancy M, and happy birthday.
Yeah.
Thanks for introducing me to Foundation. I binged season one to be ready when you started to cover season two.
Yay.
I have to comment about last week's show. Since when can androids or robots have sex? Can Data have sex? Can C-3PO have sex? Also, I have two theories.
Yes,
Demerzel's,
no.
Demerzel's job is to keep the line of the Empire.
Oh, we were just talking about this.
How suddenly is she going to be okay with it ending? I think she will kill any offspring of Day that are born. Or, and this is the crazy one, if she can have sex, maybe she can have a baby. That was her plan, and it fits, since apparently she was the one who initiated sex with Day. And her baby would be born first, so her baby would be the first in the line of succession. Crazy, but possible. Ooh, a lot there. I would say C-3PO cannot have sex because he was made by an 8-year-old boy and without sex organs.
Right.
I haven't. You said yes for Data?
Yes, Data has had sex.
Okay, interesting. Westworld.
He is fully functional.
Westworld.
More than once, I believe.
Yeah, but let's just bring in Westworld. We got plenty of sex having robots in Westworld.
Right.
So not a new idea to have robots have sex. I guess it's just how the robot's designed, right?
Right. And Demerzel is a very sophisticated advanced robot, and she has consciousness. So she is, and we've seen her physical to, you know, inside and out kind of stuff. So I think she's, biologically capable.
Seems like she can do it, yeah.
Now, whether she's capable of reproduction, I don't think so, because she doesn't have genetic material. She has parts and pieces.
There was that Rick and Morty episode, though.
Rick and Morty, I can't say that I'm a deep watcher, but boy, they cover so many topics.
Yeah, well, Rick and Morty is probably not going far anymore now that Justin Roiland is gone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, I don't know that Demerzel is going to have a baby, but that's interesting. But I think it goes back to our conversation we were just having, which is what game is she playing and to what end? I think that is really important, because if there is no more genetic dynasty, then where does she exist in the universe?
Right. Also, on the line of succession, we don't know the rules of this because we've only had clones in this world.
Mm-hmm.
But if Day were married to Dominion and then this baby was born first out of an affair, I don't know, in Game of Thrones world, that says no line of succession there for me, because you're a bastard in Game of Thrones. I know that's an offensive term in the real world, but in Game of Thrones, that's what they call you. That would be Baby Snow over in the Empire.
Out of wedlock.
Right.
Thanks, SEM. So, but write in some more theories. We want more.
Right. All right. Marilyn writes in just to let us know that, yes, you can share air with someone else underwater by breathing into their lungs. She links an article, which I will link in the show notes as well.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. I'm not arguing with – maybe I was arguing with the fact, but I was arguing it more just because of it was
– It just looked silly.
Silly action stuff that I don't need in this show. I want a little action, but there's a couple.
Right.
Places where it's
all right, last one. New patron Rocky Zim on Discord. Interesting how Terminus is shown as more advanced and functioning similar to Empire, with the nice buildings and councils. I could tell the warden was not going to have a good meeting with the prophet. When Harry wasn't coming out, I was thinking the warden was not going to enjoy his visit. I liked the Foundation priest doing a magic show to see the crowd. That was cool.
Well, thanks, Rocky Zim, for being a patron. Thanks to all our patrons. The whole priest doing the magic show stuff, really great tent revival, proselytizing, whether you're selling snake oil or whether you're selling salvation. There's a long history of that. And I think it was just a great homage and a great patterning, but then to twist it to say, and Polly explains later, look, we're trying to help these people and we're trying to provide scientific advancement so that their material lives can be better. And if we have to do it with, you know, fireworks and smoke and mirrors, so be it, which is a great twist because, you know, okay, maybe you believe that you're selling salvation, but if you're selling snake oil, you know, it's snake oil, Right. You're just trying to make a buck.
Yeah, so. I think that's contributed to Polly's alcoholism for sure.
Right. Yeah, he's upset and he's sort of medicating about it. So.
Right. All right, David, that's it for feedback. Time to talk about our outro quickly. You want to talk about our patrons quickly?
Yes.
Speaking of Rocky Zim, new patron.
Speaking of patrons, thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you to everyone who just recently subscribed. We finally broke the 82, 83 barrier. We were really stuck there for a minute, and we finally have gotten up. So thank you, everyone. To our lore masters who keep our things, keep our bits flowing, and our top tier supporters, we have Samartian, Cyrus, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Lavinia T., Duve 71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Gareth C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa, Andra B., Kwong Yu, Laura G., and Robert L. And Robert L., I shouted you out on another one. I missed you. You didn't make it on the list a couple of times. Apologies for that. You're now here. And again, thank you to you. Thank you to all our patrons, no matter what level you are at. Thank you stickers are in my hands. I have envelopes. We have a letter. I've got some nice paper. We're going to print the thank you letter on. I downloaded addresses from patrons. So those are all getting ready. You still have time. If you want to be a patron, get a sticker. You've got until, 11:59 and 59 seconds. Everyone who is a subscriber at the end of the month is going to get one of these. Super great fun stuff. So again, thank you to everyone for making a great year for us. Programming updates, John.
Programming updates. We got a few more podcasts coming out this weekend. We've got Silmarillion Stories with Marilyn Pakila. We're really excited to talk about that. And also with Marilyn, we're going to have an Earthsea episode coming out this weekend. So it's the weekend of Marilyn, really, is what you need to know. It's the weekend of Marilyn and the weekend of books. So join us for those. You can read the third book, the last part of the third book, The Farthest Shore and the Earthsea Cycle, if you want to join us for the book nook.
Can we make a note about Earthsea too, just to let folks know, and we'll send a note out on the Discord. But we're going to take a bye month for August on Earthsea.
Right. We finished the trilogy.
Yeah. And we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back in September with Tehanu. We just got a little too much with vacation schedules and whatnot in August. So September, Tehanu. And we'll pick up from there.
Cool. And then, of course, we have Secret Invasion. You're doing with John and Alicia. We got a lovely review today for Secret Invasion. So people are liking it, even if they're not liking the show. Right. So that's fun. You'll be wrapping that up this week.
Yep. We just put the final episode to bed, and we'll get that recorded and out the door shortly.
Very cool. Of course, we have Attack of the Clones coming out soon. I'm not sure exactly what day that's going to come out, but that will be out within a few days. That's our Star Wars Film Fest. Next month, you got a lot to look forward to. We're going to be starting Ahsoka. We're going to be continuing Foundation. I'm going to do a couple Shire side chats, at least one, maybe two. I'm going to bring Moses back for a One Piece episode.
Oh, nice.
And we got plenty of stuff going on. So I think Brandon and I, Brandon and I are going to talk about Skyrim.
Ooh,
it's like a 12-year-old game now, but it's, there's a new game, Starfield, coming out in September, which is by the same studio that did Skyrim. So we're going to talk about sort of the legacy of the studio, do a little bit of our hype for the new game, and talk about the impact of this game, which was one of the biggest games in the world.
In my D&D group, which we don't play anymore currently right now, but a number of years ago, we were talking about video games, and I said, oh, yeah, I don't really play anymore. And several of the group were like, Skyrim. If you're going to ever get back into games,
you'd like Skyrim.
Go play Skyrim. Yep. And I was like, wow, okay. That was like a really... So I've heard a lot of great things about Skyrim.
I have probably put hundreds of hours into that game since high school.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. It came out when I was a senior in high school, so that's how old the game is.
Okay.
But it's a good game, and it's timeless. People still play it today, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun with that chat.
Cool. All right. Great. That was a good episode. I'm looking forward to the next one.
Same here. All right. See you next week.
Thanks, everyone.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds.
Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.